Well, it is time for us to wish our listeners who are celebrating a birthday on this April 24th a very happy birthday. We have three listeners we're aware of. Clifford Edwards from Sioux City, Patricia Taylor from Cedar Falls, and Ruth Nicholson from Waterloo. All of us here at IRIS would like to wish the three of you a very happy birthday. And a reminder, you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS, and you're not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so that we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now here's Barb with today's obituaries.
Thank you, Dennis. Andres Gomez Sr., age 92, passed away peacefully on Sunday, April 14th, at Mercy One Medical Center. He was born the son of Jesse and Frances Negrete Gomez on April 5th, 1932, in Des Moines. He's lovingly survived by his children, Andres Gomez Sr., Adela Gomez Aguilar, Dolores, Feliz, Nicholas, David P. Gomez, Patricio, Macarcio Gomez, Jorge Contreras, and Juan A. Torres. 15 grandchildren and many great-grandchildren, as well as numerous nieces and nephews, other loving relatives, and many special friends. Andres was preceded in death by his parents, Jesse and Frances de Gomez, wife Olivia, known as Viva Gomez, grandson Santiago Gomez, and siblings Juan, Helen, Dolores, Pancho, and Manuel Gomez. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, April 25th at Hamilton's Funeral Home at 605 Lyon Street. Funeral service will begin at 11 a.m. on Friday, April 26th, also at the funeral home, followed by burial at Glendale Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be directed to the family in memory of Andres. Condolences may be expressed online at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Dennis Edward Green, 67, of Green Valley, Arizona, passed away on Wednesday, April 3rd, in a traffic accident near his home. Dennis was born September 17, 1954, in Denver, Colorado, to Bob and Charlotte Green. He was the third of four children and graduated high school from Bountiful, Utah in 1973, having earned all-state accolades in basketball and subsequently playing at Idaho State University, as well as Weber State University. Dennis graduated and followed his business degree with a master's in business administration from Colorado State University in 1979. He went on to have a fulfilling career of over 30 years in human resources. He retired from his own consulting business of employer-employee relationships in 2018 while living in St. George, Utah. In August of 2023, he moved to Green Valley, Arizona. Dennis married Joni Nicholas Green of Ogden, Utah in 1980. They were blessed with two boys, Ben and Brady Green. He later married Beth Williams Green of St. George, Utah in 2004. Dennis spent countless hours enjoying the great outdoors on his bicycle, hiking, swimming, and other seasonal activities. Condolences to Dennis's mother, Charlotte Green, who lives in Urbandale. Ben and his wife, Sam Green, their children, Josephine and Nicholas of St. George, Brady and his wife, Lynette Green, and Cameron and their son of Seattle, Washington. Surviving siblings are Robert Green of Ankeny, Larry Green of Mesa, Arizona, and Charlene Bagley of Ketchum, Idaho. A memorial service will be held at Isles Westover Funeral Home in Des Moines on Saturday, June 8th. In lieu of flowers, donate to any food pantry in your area or the Salvation Army. Karen Donnelly, 83, passed away April 20th with family by her side. Private family services will be held, and Karen will be buried alongside her parents at the Forest Cemetery in Oskaloosa. In lieu of flowers, please consider making a donation to your favorite charity in Karen's honor. Karen was born, the only child of Thomas and Letha Anderson, on March 18, 1941. She was raised in Oskaloosa, Iowa. In her youth, Karen enjoyed playing the organ and singing at the Baptist Church and at various weddings and funerals over the years. Karen graduated alongside the Oskaloosa High School class of 1959. She continued her education at William Penn University. Karen married and had one daughter, Shelley. Karen enjoyed being a stay-at-home mother for 18 years. Once Shelley was grown, Karen started volunteering her time with the Des Moines General Hospital Guild and later was employed by the General Hospital Gift Shop, where she made many friendships. She also worked for Richmond Gordman Department Store until her retirement. Above all else, Karen loved spending time with her daughter, grandsons, and great-grandchildren. She made many memories with them over the years. Those memories and her generous spirit will be fondly remembered by those she leaves behind. Karen is survived by her daughter, Shelley Henry, grandsons Tyler Henry and Joshua Henry, and great-grandchildren Will, Marshall, and Collison. She was preceded in death by her parents and her great-granddaughter, Rory. Catherine Faye Schoonover Harvey, 90, formerly of Des Moines and Guthrie Center, passed away on April 19th in Parrish, Florida. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 27th, at McLaren's Rest Haven Chapel in West Des Moines, with visitation from 10 a.m. until service time. Burial will be at Rest Haven Cemetery in West Des Moines. Memorial contributions may be directed to a local hospice of the donor's choice. Diane Lynn Bishop Pauley of Stewart, age 66, passed away peacefully on April 20th at her rural home in Stewart, Iowa. Born on March 23, 1958, in Des Moines, Diana was a beacon of kindness and love throughout her life, touching the hearts of the people and animals who came in contact with her. A gathering of family and friends and visitation will be held from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. on Friday, April 26th at the Johnson Family Funeral Home and Crematory, Stewart Chapel. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, April 27th at the Stewart Mount Vernon United Methodist Church. The service will be live streamed for all to participate and can be found at facebook.com/Johnson Family. A time of fellowship and luncheon will be held immediately following the services at the church. The burial will take place at 2 p.m. Saturday, April 27th at the Norwalk Cemetery in Norwalk. Online condolences may be left at johnsonfamilyfuneralhome.com. Memorial contributions may be made to the Diana Pauley Memorial Fund, which will go to the Stewart Mount Vernon Methodist Church and the caring hospice staff of Unity Point at Home out of the Jefferson, Iowa office. Thomas Charles Goldman passed away peacefully on Monday, April 22nd, surrounded by his beloved family. He was 77 years old. Born in Des Moines to Harold and Kate Goldman in 1946, Tom's life was marked by a relentless pursuit of adventure and a steadfast commitment to his community. He graduated from Mochel High School in 1964 and went on to earn his degree from the University of Iowa in 1969. In 1978, Tom embarked on a lifelong adventure with his beloved wife, Kathy Clark Goldman, spanning 47 remarkable years filled with love, laughter, and extraordinary experiences. As the owner and president of Iowa Paint Manufacturing Company from 1983 to 2005, Tom demonstrated unwavering dedication to both his employees and the growth of his business. An adventurer at heart, Tom found joy in the great outdoors, whether sailing, boating, fishing, or developing and nurturing his beloved pucker brush. His favorite times were spent with a good cigar, roaring fire, and a shot of tequila with friends and family. If you know, you know. He cherished his family and delighted in every moment spent with his four grandchildren. One of Tom's biggest delights was the family tradition of playing croquet and letting his competitors believe they were going to win until the very last shot. Tom is preceded in death by his parents, Kate and Errol Goldman, and leaves behind a legacy of love and inspiration that will continue to live on through his wife, Kathy Clark Goldman, his daughter Jennifer Nemechek, his son Bradley Goldman, his grandchildren, and his brothers David and Bart. Tom's home was at Morningstar Memory Care at Jordan Creek for the last 2 years of his life, where he was professionally and lovingly cared for by the wonderful staff. The family wishes to acknowledge and thank them and the care professionals from Home Instead and Suncrest Hospice for the loving care provided. An extra special thank you goes to Cindy Jordan, who guided Tom's team and was a constant companion. In lieu of flowers, the family asks that you please make donations to the Kate Goldman's Children Theater at the Des Moines Playhouse, the Association for the Preservation of Clear Lake, or a charitable organization of the donor's preference. There will be a private family service held. And Joanne Utznitzer, 92, of Carlisle, passed away peacefully on Friday, April 19th, at Westview Care Center in Indianola. Joanne was born at home in Atlantic, Iowa, on July 14, 1931, to John and Margarita Clausen Boyd. She was the first of five children born to this union. Joanne was a graduate of Roosevelt High School in Des Moines, class of 1950. The week after graduation, she married the love of her life, Merle Utznitzer, in Des Moines on June 30, 1950. Joanne and her family moved to Carlisle in 1957, where she continued to live until she moved to Westview Care Center in March of 2023. She dedicated her life to the service of children in her community. Over a span of 16 years, she drove a school bus with unwavering dedication, ensuring the safe transportation of her young passengers. For more than 25 years following her retirement, she continued to touch lives by offering at-home daycare services. She was a beacon of love and care, her home a sanctuary for children and parents alike. Joanne is survived by her loving children, Gary of Prospero, Texas, Diane Cox of The Colony, Texas, Vicki Anderson of Gilman City, Missouri, Martha Ross of Carlisle, and Kim Hartshorn of Carlisle. Three sisters, one brother, 12 grandchildren, 15 great-grandchildren, one great-great-granddaughter, and many nieces and nephews. Joanne was preceded in death by her husband Merle, her parents, her brother Robert Boyd, and son-in-law Glenn Bud Ross, Peter Anderson, and Jean Cox. Visitation will be held on Thursday, April 25th, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Peterson Funeral Home, 415 School Street in Carlisle, followed by an Eastern Star service at 7 p.m. Funeral services will be held at Peterson Funeral Home on Friday, April 26th at 10 a.m., followed by the interment on Saturday, April 27th at 11 a.m. at Carlisle City Cemetery. Memorials may go to the Carlisle Fire Department or the Shrine Hospital for Children in Joanne's name. Online condolences may be made at petersonfuneralservice.com.
Thank you. That concludes today's obituaries. Turning back to some national news. Foreign aid packages advance in the Senate. Biden promises to sign bills after final passage. Billions of dollars in foreign aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan advanced in the Senate on Tuesday, heading for a vote on final passage days after the House of Representatives abruptly ended a months-long stalemate and approved the assistance in a rare Saturday session. The Senate voted by an overwhelming 80-19 vote in favor of advancing the package of four bills passed by the House, far more than the 60 needed to pave the way for a vote on final passage. One of the bills provided $61 billion for Ukraine, a second, $26 billion for Israel, and a third, $8.12 billion to counter communist China in the Indo-Pacific. A fourth includes a potential ban on the social media app TikTok, measures for the transfer of seized Russian assets to Ukraine, and new sanctions on Iran. Democratic President Joe Biden has promised to sign it into law as soon as it passes the Senate. Two U.S. officials told Reuters the administration was already preparing a $1 billion military aid package for Ukraine, the first to be sourced from the bill. That would clear the way for shipments of military assistance to Ukraine within days, boosting morale for its troops fighting Russian invaders. The influx of weapons should improve Kyiv's chances of averting a major Russian breakthrough in the east, analysts said, although it would have been more helpful if the aid had come closer to when Biden requested it last year. This is an inflection point in history. Western democracy perhaps faced its greatest threat since the end of the Cold War, Senate Democratic Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said in the Senate after the procedural vote. The aid package could be the last approved for Ukraine until after elections in November. It was not immediately clear how the money for Israel would affect the conflict in Gaza. Israel already receives billions of dollars in annual U.S. security assistance. The package includes humanitarian assistance, which supporters hope will help Palestinians in Gaza. The Israel bill passed the House by an overwhelming 366-58, with 21 Republicans and 37 Democrats opposed. Republican no votes came from hardliners who generally oppose foreign aid. Democratic objectors demanded more to ease the devastating humanitarian toll of Israel's campaign in Gaza as it retaliates for the October 7th Hamas attacks that killed 1,200 people and resulted in about 250 hostages. The Israeli military assault that followed those attacks has killed more than 34,000 people in Gaza, according to Gaza health authorities. The Senate passed security aid for Ukraine, Israel, and the Indo-Pacific more than 2 months ago with support of 70% of the 100-member chamber, both Republicans and Democrats. The White House said Biden told Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in a phone call Monday that his administration would provide new security assistance to meet Ukraine's urgent battlefield and air defense needs as soon as he signs the bill into law. Also on the world stage, plastics, a growing threat around the world. In Ottawa, nations gathered to consider solutions. On the eve of an international meeting to debate a global treaty on plastics pollution, Earth Day 2024 on Monday highlighted the planet's growing problem of plastics in events ranging from beach cleanups and seminars to an environmental demonstration in Seoul, South Korea. Since the first Earth Day in 1970, plastics has become more ubiquitous in our environment. It's now considered a crisis of global proportion, according to the United Nations Intergovernmental Committee to develop an international legally binding instrument on plastic pollution, including in the marine environment. This is right there with climate change as a primordial threat to the planet. Pediatrician Leonard Trazande, a researcher and professor at New York University, told journalists at the Society of Environmental Journalists meeting in Philadelphia earlier in April. Billions of bits of plastic infiltrate waterways and oceans and are consumed in beverages and food and are found in internal organs of people and wildlife. A 2023 paper published by the National Library of Medicine and others shows microplastics can wreak havoc on hormones and contribute to a range of health problems. On Tuesday in Ottawa and Canada, the UN committee began days of talks aimed at reaching a draft agreement on plastics in the environment. It's the fourth meeting since 2022 when the UN agreed to develop a treaty to curb the flow of plastics into the environment. Here's a breakdown of some key terms and major issues expected to be discussed. Plastic has been found in every corner of the world and has turned up in drinking water, beer, salt, and honey, according to Oceana, an ocean conservation group. While some may think of plastic pollution as plastic shopping bags or soda bottles, it's the tiniest particles, microplastics and nanoplastics, that are raising the big concerns. Microplastics, for example, are tiny particles of polymers less than 5 millimeters long, no longer than a grain of rice. They come from plastic bottles, synthetic clothing fibers, car tires, and other products as plastics break down slowly. Anika Dzurlinga, a program lead at the National Institute of Health, said, quote, "We know very little about what these microplastics or even smaller pieces of plastics, known as nanoplastics, can do to human health in the short or long term, or even what they can do to the health of sea turtles and other animals that live in the ocean," end quote. Nanoplastics are even smaller, only 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter, according to the National Nanotechnology Initiative. By comparison, a strand of human DNA is 2.5 nanometers in diameter, and a human hair is approximately 80,000 to 100,000 nanometers wide, the initiative states. The annual production of plastic, including polymer resins and fibers, increased from 2 million tons in 1950 to 459.75 million tons in 2019, according to Our World in Data, citing a 2023 paper about plastic production published in the Journal of Science Advances. By 2022, estimates suggest plastic production exceeded more than 400 million tons. Estimates suggest that less than 10% of plastic waste in the U.S. is recycled, while a majority heads to the landfills. Plastic and particles it produces can be found from the Arctic tundra to the deepest oceans, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the UN. It includes everything from large items such as bottles, jugs, and plastic bags floating in the ocean and washing up on beaches to the particles that a recent study found may be linked to an increased risk of heart attack, stroke, and death. One study found that bottled water can contain 10 to 100 times more plastic bits than previously thought, while other studies have found microplastics in clouds, rain, and in the placentas of pregnant people. For some, the bigger concerns beyond the tide of plastic bits are the chemicals and contaminants they carry that have been linked to endocrine disruption and other abnormalities in the human body and harmful fossil fuel emissions from the production of plastics. Studies show that microplastics accumulate chemicals and pathogens on their surfaces. The UN committee is scheduled to discuss polymers, waste management, trade, pollution, financing, and technologies. It tries to reach an agreement among the world's governments in an effort similar to the talks in Paris that produced the Global Treaty on Climate Change in 2015. Reuters has reported that many plastics and petrochemical producing countries, including China, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, do not support language in favor of production limits. Last week, in advance of the treaty talks, the American Chemistry Council, a trade industry for chemical manufacturers in the U.S., released a study by Oxford Economics, which concluded a production cap on virgin plastics would carry major economic costs. The State Department says the U.S. supports the development of an ambitious global agreement on plastic pollution that has universal obligations throughout the lifetime of plastics. A major focus of the proposed international treaty is plastic in the marine environment. Millions of tons of microplastics, ranging in size from the width of a pencil to smaller than a sesame seed, find their way into the oceans, according to the National Institutes. The particles move into people through the food chain and also attract pollutants that are carried into new environments. An estimated 33 billion pounds of plastic wash into the ocean every year. About 2 garbage trucks worth of plastics every minute, according to Oceana. April Burt, a conservation scientist with the University of Oxford, said, "It's not too late to stem the flow. The Global Plastics Treaty gives us the opportunity to turn the tide on plastic pollution, from policy on the manufacture of plastics to retailer responsibilities and dealing with legacy plastics."
Trump looks to Nixon in high court case. At landmark arguments Thursday in Donald Trump's long-shot Supreme Court bid for presidential immunity, his test case is Richard Nixon. First, Nixon avoided criminal charges from Watergate through a presidential pardon. Several years later, he set the standard for whether presidents can face civil lawsuits. An Air Force weapons analyst sued Nixon, claiming he had been fired in retaliation for telling Congress about massive cost overruns in the Defense Department. A closely divided Supreme Court said in 1982 Nixon couldn't be held liable for official actions taken during his presidency. They said the prospect of civil suits would be too distracting and make a president unnecessarily cautious. Now the Supreme Court will hear arguments on whether the same logic should apply to Trump's attempt to throw out the federal criminal charges he faces for attempting to steal the 2020 election. It is a novel question because Trump is the first president, former or current, to be criminally charged. Many experts think the justices are likely to reject Trump's claim of absolute immunity. But even if they do, how long it takes them to issue an opinion and whether a majority finds that presidents have some immunity will determine whether Trump can be tried before the November election. The first and most important pivotal question is whether the court will rule in a way that allows the case to then continue immediately, said Harry Littman, a former U.S. attorney and deputy assistant attorney general. The Supreme Court's decision to hear the appeal of the presumptive GOP nominee has already diminished the chances that Special Prosecutor Jack Smith's case, which is supposed to go to trial in March, can be completed before the election. The delay has critics charging that the court may have already effectively granted Trump immunity if there's no trial and Trump wins the election, putting him in a position to halt the Justice Department's prosecution. In Nixon v. Fitzgerald, the court said presidents are immune both while in office and after from civil damages from official acts, including those on the outer perimeter of a president's official responsibilities. Trump wants that same protection extended to criminal cases. Otherwise, his lawyers argue, the threat of future prosecution will become a political cudgel to influence the most sensitive and controversial presidential decisions, taking away the strength of the presidency. The federal district judge overseeing Trump's trial in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals didn't buy it. For the purpose of this criminal case, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump, and with all the defenses of any other criminal defendant. The unanimous three-judge appeals panel court wrote in a resounding rejection of Trump's claim. Even if Trump's actions were done in his official capacity rather than in his personal one as a candidate, the public's interest in the enforcement of criminal law is significant, the court said. That's particularly true in a case involving a presidential election, they wrote. Smith argues that the fact that President Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon shows that presidents have never been expected to be immune from criminal prosecution. Alex Reinert, a criminal law expert at the Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law in New York, said the Supreme Court likely agreed to hear Trump's appeal because of the importance of the presidential immunity issue. Reinert, her clerk for former Justice Stephen Breyer, said the justices will try to probe what level of immunity would balance the rule of law against the need for the presidential protection against baseless and harassing prosecutions. Some hope the court will issue a narrow ruling specific to Trump's case and not explore other scenarios. Donald Trump has articulated an outrageous, unprecedented, and ahistorical assertion of absolute immunity, said former Obama White House ethics czar Norm Eisen. The Supreme Court need not stray into other questions just because Trump has made it easy for them. They should decide this case. If the Supreme Court rules the presidents enjoy criminal immunity only in specific circumstances, Trump wants the protection to spread as broadly as possible and wants the court to direct that any test be applied through additional proceedings before his trial can start. Smith has told the court any qualifications it puts on immunity should not delay the trial. If the justices agree, a trial could start before the election, though it might not finish, Reinert said. I think it would take a lot to get to a trial before November, he said, but I do think it's possible.
And a few more state shorts from Nashville, Tennessee. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee's signature proposal for a statewide school voucher program is dead for the year, with Lee acknowledging there is no way forward for the legislation despite last-ditch negotiations through the weekend to revive the stalled bill. And from Austin, Texas, a coalition of advocates has joined one of Texas' most famous inmates to sue the state over extreme temperatures in prison cells, arguing in federal court that inmates are being, quote, cooked to death, and staff members are suffering heat-related injuries without air conditioning. From Payson, Utah, a protest at a Utah middle school prompted district officials to address rumors of alleged biting and licking initiated by furries, according to reports from multiple outlets. And from Hopewell, Virginia, Hopewell's outgoing city attorney has recommended that the Virginia Attorney General's office look into claims by an alleged department employee that the city's treasurer improperly removed herself from the state's agency list of delinquent taxpayers without attempting to settle her own tax debts. Well, I'm going to take a break here. So for the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Barb DeHeck and Dennis May. It has been our pleasure to read for you. And now we're going to take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Patty Daniels and myself, Scott Splavik. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Now here's Patty with our first article.
Thank you, Scott. Shock of Columbine misled us to believe schools aren't safe. Written for us by James Allen Fox, and he is an opinion contributor. When it comes to mass killing, April 20th is a day of infamy. On that date, 25 years ago, two teenagers became arguably the most notorious school shooters in U.S. history by gunning down a dozen classmates and one teacher at Columbine High in Littleton, Colorado. The 1999 Columbine Massacre was neither the first nor the deadliest school shooting in our nation's past, but by all measures, it's the most significant in its impact on school policies, public attitudes, and popular culture. For the first time, the horrific drama was broadcast live. Recordings of the two assailants planning and practicing for the assault were released publicly. Regrettably, a Columbine video game, T-shirts, and other cultural artifacts gave the two shooters the celebrity status they sought. Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris fully expected to achieve fame and notoriety. As one of the assailants predicted in the so-called Columbine basement tapes, excuse me, "I know we're going to have followers because we're so expletive godlike. And their influence has persisted ever since, with more than 100 copycats committing or attempting to commit similar attacks at schools across America. The Columbine effect is much wider than the occasional acts of copycats. It includes ways in which schools have been transformed in terms of security and the widespread perception of students and their parents that schools are unsafe." In the aftermath of Columbine, parents began to purchase bullet-resistant backpacks for their children, and schools began to stage lockdown drills that have questionable value but unnerve many impressionable children with attempts at realism. Columbine might have been the catalyst for widespread panic, but various data reports have served to reinforce and increase the sense of danger. For example, the Center for Homeland Defense and Security's K-12 school shooting database suggests that the number of incidents has grown exponentially, with nearly 1,000 cases since 2021. Importantly, the definition of a school shooting used in this database is quite broad. A gun is fired, brandished, or bullet hits school property, regardless of the number of victims, including 0, time, day, or season. My analysis as a professor of criminology of the K-12 school shootings data for the past 3 years indicates that nearly 90% of the shootings did not take place inside the school itself, but in parking lots, athletic fields, or school buses, where lockdown drills and metal detectors are not relevant. Of course, frightened parents think about the threat of a Columbine-type massacre when confronted with these statistics. However, the overwhelming majority of incidents have little to do with the safety of their children while in school. The fears of students and their parents are focused more on active shootings, whether they are students or outsiders roaming the hallways armed with a powerful instrument of death. Based on my review of FBI documents, since Columbine there have been 50 of that specific type of attack, resulting in victim injuries or fatalities for an average of 2 per year. Of course, that is out of nearly 130,000 schools in America. Although understandable, our response to school shootings, requiring students to participate in active shooter drills, arming teachers, installing security equipment, is out of proportion with the actual risk. These actions intensify fears rather than alleviate them by suggesting to students that a bullseye is on their backs. While there might be a handful of students who idolize the Columbine shooters and decide to follow their lead, History suggests that we might reduce fears as well as the risk for downplaying the threat of school shootings. From 1996 through 2001, there were 8 multiple fatality school shootings in the United States, prompting newsman Dan Rather in March 2001 to declare that school shootings were a national epidemic. But then there were none for the next 4 years. Once the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks took place, Americans shifted their attention and concerns away from school shootings and squarely on a different threat to their safety. I'm certainly not suggesting that we invite a tragedy to deflect attention from school shootings, only that we keep the risk in its proper perspective. Schools are indeed safe, offer structure and supervision. Children are safer in school than out. Now, James Allen Fox is the Lippman Professor of Criminology, Law, and Public Policy at Northeastern University and author of Violence and Security on Campus, From Preschool Through College.
The other opinion piece today is entitled, He Was Locked Up and Now He Keeps People Out of Prison. It's written by James E. Causey, who is an Ideas Lab reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where this column originally appeared. 10 years ago, that's how long in prison Ruben Gaona received for his role in a drug ring that transported cocaine and marijuana from Texas to Milwaukee in March of 2010. Gaona grew up in El Paso with a single mom and 5 siblings. His father was mentally and physically abusive to his mother. One time, his father broke into his bedroom window with a gun and threatened to kill the family. We called 911 on him. After that, my mom knew she had to leave him, Gaona said. His mother, Maria Reyes, relocated the family to Milwaukee's South Side in June of 1996, making the trek on a Greyhound bus. Gaona was 15. During his senior year at Pulaski High School in 1999, Gaona received life-changing news. He would be a father. Faced with limited job options, Gaona decided to join the U.S. Navy for the direction he needed. At first, everything seemed to be going well. The Navy provided a meaningful alternative to what he had seen growing up. He quickly developed a passion for it. But 45 days before he was set to re-enlist, he was told he couldn't because of a back injury. The Navy determined Gaona was unfit for sea. He received an honorable discharge and was back on Milwaukee's South Side. That's when he made the dumbest decision of his life. On March 17, 2010, Gaona was one of 17 defendants charged in a drug conspiracy and money laundering case. Several of his siblings also were involved. Despite receiving monthly visits from his family and communicating with them through letters and phone calls, the absence of their physical presence was deeply felt. Nonetheless, his mother remained a stalwart source of support. Twice a month, Reyes drove Gaona's wife and kids nearly 6 hours to visit him in prison. Their unwavering support was crucial for Gaona, as it helped him get through tough times. However, not all prisoners are fortunate enough to have someone to support them, leading many to reoffend once they are released. Gaona made a promise to his mother that he would never let her down again. Nearly 13 years later, he has dedicated himself to helping people who were once in prison. His nonprofit organization, My Way Out, has been successful in keeping more than 600 people out of prison by providing essential services such as housing, employment, and transportation. The program has a 90% success rate. The effort began as thousands of prisoners were being released early from state and federal prisons to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Many were released with just the clothing they came with and without a solid reintegration plan to avoid going back to prison. My Way Out offers support for things that might not be apparent to most of us. For instance, when a client needed a winter coat, Gaona's team purchased a new one for the man. When another landed a job but needed reliable transportation, the team bought the man a 10-speed bike. Gaona, age 42, said since his team doesn't have office space, they can meet the client where they are. If someone calls me right now, I ask them where they are and go to them to make it easier. We do a lot of meetings in coffee shops and the library, he said. It's hard enough for them. We don't want to make it more difficult. If they cannot provide needed services, they collaborate with other reentry programs to ensure clients receive what they need. The program operates on donations from organizations such as the United Way, Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Bader Philanthropies, Milwaukee Bucks Foundation, Roots and Wings, and others. More than 70% of the clients served are African American or Hispanic. Anthony Dodd, assistant superintendent at the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center, called My Way Out a valuable safety net. Addressing stable housing and employment are critical to the success of men and women, and Gaona has helped hundreds in this area. Dodd said that after a person has served their time, there needs to be a higher level of forgiveness and second chances. Approximately 95% of state prisoners will be released at some point, with 80% of them placed under parole supervision. Many people don't consider public safety in terms of ensuring that formerly incarcerated individuals have access to stable housing, good jobs, and transportation. However, Dodd said, these factors are crucial in reducing recidivism rates. My Way Out stands out from other reentry organizations because all its employees have been incarcerated. Frank Harris Sr., age 63, felt out of touch with technology after serving 26 years in prison for homicide. My Way Out employees helped him overcome his fears. When Harris was incarcerated, his son was only 14 years old. One thing he always wanted to do was to take him out to a Brewers baseball game. My Way Out gave him that opportunity once he was released by providing him with two tickets to see the Brewers play at American Family Field. Frank Harris Jr., age 44, said it was an experience he would never forget. I've been to a baseball game before. I've just never been with my dad. It was a perfect day. I don't even remember who won the game. I know that I enjoyed that time with my dad, Harris Jr. said. At an event held at Bader Philanthropies in January, Harris Sr. and other individuals shared their positive experiences with the organization. One man spoke about how the organization provided him and his son with safe housing, while another thanked Gaona for always being available to provide assistance regardless of the time of day. Another shared how the staff helped him find employment, which ultimately led to him landing a better job as a barber. During his speech, Gaona shared a quote he had written down 5 years into his sentence that changed his life. He now lives by these words. Quote, "I can't" does not exist, as it's merely an excuse we tell ourselves to avoid reaching our full potential. Gaona's story mirrors that of many clients he serves today, but he wants them to know that they have the power to create a new reflection. And again, this was written by James E. Causey, who is an Ideas Lab reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where this column originally appeared.
Sports on TV. All times are Eastern. Wednesday, April 24th. Hockey. National Hockey League, 7 p.m. ESPN. Boston at Toronto, 9:30 p.m. ESPN. Vegas at Dallas, 10 p.m. TBS. LA Kings at Edmonton. Basketball. National Basketball Association, 7 p.m. TNT, Miami at Boston, 9:30 p.m. TNT, New Orleans at Oklahoma City. Baseball, Major League Baseball, 1:15 p.m. MLBN, Arizona at St. Louis, 3:45 p.m. MLBN, New York Mets at San Francisco, 4:07 p.m. MLBN Baltimore at LA Angels, 7:05 p.m. Amazon/MLBN Oakland at New York Yankees, 7:20 p.m. MLBN Miami at Atlanta, 7:40 p.m. ESPN Toronto at Kansas City, 8:05 p.m. MLBN Seattle at Texas, 8:40 p.m. MLBN San Diego at Colorado. Soccer, English Premier League, 2:45 p.m., PEAC AFC Bournemouth at Wolverhampton Wanderers. 3 p.m., PEAC Sheffield United at Manchester United. PEAC Liverpool at Everton. And USA Newcastle United at Crystal Palace. And I'm going to read some more sports. The biggest four post-spring concerns facing Iowa football. Written forth by Chad Liskow, Iowa City. Spring football is usually a time for optimism, a 15-practice period, guaranteed to have no losses on the scoreboard. It's a 5-week stretch to examine on-field progress within a program. And there was a lot to like from what Iowa accomplished, up to and including Saturday's open practice at Kinnick Stadium. Atop the list, it feels like a good groundwork was laid for the new Kyle Shanahan-style offense of coordinator Tim Lester. The team's top player, tight end Luke Leahy, looks 100% after right leg surgery. The Hawkeye secondary seems well-stocked to replace the loss of first-round NFL draft pick Cooper DeJean, with John Nestor in particular emerging as Phil Parker's next potential big thing. The punting situation also won't experience a stark drop-off after getting eyes on the booming punt from Australian freshman Reese Dakin. But now, it's time to focus on what needs the most attention and improvement between now and Iowa's August 31st season opener against Illinois State. With most of a salty defense returning, an optimism that LeVar Woods' special teams will continue to play at a high level, the Hawkeyes have the potential to compete for a spot in the expanded 12-team college football playoff. There is time to take needed steps forward, but the playoff-level defense provides urgency on the tasks at hand. Here are the four most pressing concerns to address over the next 4 months. Obviously, quarterback has to rank number one. Based on what we saw last season and Saturday's practice, the Hawkeyes absolutely must upgrade their health insurance roster coverage for Cade McNamara. This is hardly a unique or novel opinion, and we knew this even before Deacon Hill and Marco Lanez took 99% of the snaps Saturday. The NCAA transfer portal is open until April 30th, so new potential names can emerge over the next week or so. Ideally, Iowa needs a quarterback who can take over the number two role and not only push McNamara for the starting job, but become a bona fide favorite for being QBI in 2025. From what we saw and heard from Lester's motion-heavy NFL-style offense, McNamara is a very good fit. Lester's offense requires a player who can make quick reads and accurate on-time throws. Think Brock Purdy with the San Francisco 49ers, while occasionally being able to improvise. Hill and Lanez were not yet in that category, which is why Lester called plays this spring as if McNamara was healthy. There is so much riding on McNamara's health that it does make Hawkeye fans nervous. He should be full go by June, according to Lester and head coach Kirk Ferentz, which would be 9 months post-surgery on the ACL in his left knee. That said, Lanez showed enough Saturday to become the number two quarterback pre-portal behind McNamara, which is probably in part why Hill entered the transfer portal on Tuesday morning. Lanez's ability to run and improving accuracy gives Lester a chance to run a Marco package for games this fall, at minimum. If coaches and recruiting director Tyler Barnes have been successful come August, the QB pecking order would be 1. McNamara, 2. Porto Guy TBD, 3. Lanez, and 4. James Ressar. Ressar arrives in June, and true freshmen at Iowa are typically ticketed for scout team duty. So to count on him as contending for the number two spot probably isn't realistic. And it sounds like an upgrade is very possible. Iowa is expected to get a visit this week from Missouri State transfer wideout Raylan Sharp. Sharp isn't the big X receiver that Iowa has rarely had, measuring 5'9" and 175 pounds. But he has been a producer at the FCS level, posting a school record 73 catches for 991 yards and 7 touchdowns last season as a sophomore at Missouri State. Ferenc likes adding transfers who are moving up in class, as Seth Anderson did a year ago. Sharp feels like a good potential fit for what Lester likes to do, which is getting playmakers the ball in space. Sharp may not be the instant starter type that ideally Iowa would add, but an extra experienced body helps now and for the future. Coming out of spring, it seems Caleb Brown, 5'10", 197 pounds, and Caden Wetchen, 5'10", 196, are the only two wide receivers who are locks to be contributors. They both have a chance to be really good football players, Ferenc said Saturday. Anderson, 6'0", 180, desperately needs some good luck on the health front. He missed most of the spring ball for the second straight year. Jarriott Buell, 6'1", 185, and Dayton Howard, 6'4", 195, have longer frames and good potential, but they're only speculative stocks for now. Terrell Washington Jr., 5'11", 195, switched to wide receiver, looks like an early success, but he's very raw. Incoming freshman Reese Van Der Zee looks like a true X prospect, but he's new. Good health and consistency have been problems for this wide receiver's room over the past 3 years, and it was concerning to see Jacob Bostic enter the transfer portal abruptly. Remember, when Iowa had two first-round tight ends in 2018, the team's leading receiver was Iowa Western transfer Nick Easley, so production can come from unlikely places. Lester and wide receivers coach John Budmeier need to feel good about their top five or six by the time fall camp kicks into high gear in August. If not now, when? The loss of Caden Proctor, again, does hurt the on-field talent level and puts a lot of pressure on, probably, Mason Richmond to be at his best in his fourth year starting at left tackle for Iowa. The Hawkeyes have so much experience up front, and Ferenc said he thought the line was becoming more physical than he's seen in years. But this is the year that experience needs to pay off. Coaches on both sides of the ball said the line has uncorked a lot of long running plays in spring practice. That seems encouraging, as did their performance in Saturday's open practice. But we've seen such poor results up front over the past 2.5 seasons that it's hard to get excited. Iowa did add a preferred walk-on transfer in North Dakota's Cade Baroud, a former Southeast Polk prep who started 12 games at center last season and earned freshman All-America honors at the FCS level. Baroud, 6'2", 305, could give Iowa more flexibility to move around Tyler Elsbury, who has been serving as Logan Jones' backup center, while also providing a starting option in 2025 with experience. You know how Ferenc values the center position. And after this season, Iowa will definitely be without Richmond, Elsbury, Connor Colby, and Nick DeJong, and Jones will likely enter the NFL draft, but does have the option for a sixth year. Richmond was playing while badly hurt most of the season. Jones had shoulder surgery for a nagging issue and was hampered by a high ankle injury in November and December. Bottom line, this was a get-well spring for the offensive line and now becomes a prove-it summer for O-line coach George Barnett. The Hawkeyes need to see experience translate to the field, and they need to crank up the development in-house because the 2025 line will be mostly new. That's not to doubt the position group headed by Kevin Bell and Jane Neiman, but for Iowa to generate ample pass rush and create more turnovers, a big emphasis for the defensive backfield this offseason, there needs to be more development and push from the defensive line. Gone at defensive end over the past 2 years are 2023 first-round NFL draft pick Lucas Van Ness, and now Joe Evans, who had 9.5 sacks last season and is number 4 all-time in Iowa history in that category. The top returning sacker for Iowa is linebacker Nick Jackson with 4. Expected starting defensive ends Deontay Craig and Ethan Herkett combined for 3 sacks in 14 games last season, all by Craig. And backups Max Llewellyn and Brian Allen are inconsistent but have high potential. Craig was playing hurt last year, so there's a good chance he rebounds. He looked good Saturday. One concerning part about the defensive line is that Iowa cannot afford expected tackle starters Yahya Black, 6'5", 315, or Aaron Graves, 6'4", 293, to get hurt. Both players are already good, and both could be great. Black does have an injury history and was sidelined during the final spring practice. Graves, for all his low-fat mass and upside, is still just 20 years old and has never started. Behind them, though, are questions. Jeremiah Pittman looks like a rotational guy, but not a difference maker. Losing athletic tackle Antirio Thompson to the transfer portal to Western Michigan hurt. Who else can emerge? It looks like Jeff Bowie had a good practice, and Maddox Boscherding Johnson also stood out. Defensive coordinator Phil Parker mentioned walk-ons Luke Gaffney and Will Hubert as having good springs. Iowa exited spring practice already 4 scholarships over the 85 maximum once freshmen arrive in June. It feels unlikely that any scholarship openings created will go to the defensive line, but that can't be ruled out. If Iowa has to go into the fall banking on heavy snaps from Black and Graves, those two could wear down come November. And the Hawkeyes columnist Chad Listkow has served for 29 years with the Des Moines Register and USA Today Sports Network. Chad is the 2023 INA Iowa Sports Columnist of the Year and NSMA Co-Sports Writer of the Year in Iowa. Join Chad's text message group, free for subscribers, at hawkcentral.com, Hawkeye Texts. Follow Chad at Chad Listkow on Twitter.
That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register. I'm Scott Splavik, and my partner at the microphone has been Patty Daniels. Earlier, you heard Barb DeHeck and Dennis May. You can listen to Iowa's programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.